Before we begin today's show, basketball fans know with real guidance and the right coach, NBA teams can go from good to great. Just like real help from your State Farm agent can make all the difference in protecting what matters most. Just remember what happened to the Warriors when Steve Kerr came in there? I mean, they were good. Then they were great. You can find examples of that all the way back through NBA history. Pat Riley did it a couple of different places. Red Auerbach did it. Anyway, talk to your State Farm agent today about combining your home and auto insurance and get a teammate who can help guide you through whatever life throws your way, like a great coach. And you want the real deal, like a good neighbor. State Farm is there. And when you're running a business, whether it's from home or an office, HR issues can really hurt you. There's wrongful termination suits, minimum wage requirements, labor regulations, all sorts of stuff that can go wrong. On top of all that, HR manager salaries aren't cheap. They make an average of $70,000 a year. Bambee, spelled B-A-M-B-E-E, was created specifically for small business. With Bambee, you can change HR from your biggest liability to your biggest strength, because you can get a dedicated HR manager, craft HR policy, and maintain your compliance, all for just $99 a month. And your dedicated HR manager is available by phone, email, or real-time chat. From onboarding to terminations, they customize your policies to fit your business and help you manage your employees day-to-day, all for just $99 a month. Month-to-month, no hidden fees, cancel anytime. You didn't start your business because you wanted to spend time with HR compliance. Let Bambee help, and you can get your free HR audit today. Go to Bambee.com/hoop right now to get your free HR audit. That's Bambee.com/hoop, spelled BAM to the BEE.com/hoop. And one final thing before we get started here, I just wanted to give you a weekly reminder about The Last Dance. Episodes 9 and 10, the final two installments of the 10-part docuseries on Michael Jordan, the 1990s Bulls, will air at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN this coming Sunday. Immediately following the broadcast, be sure to check out Jalen Jacoby, The After Show, the wrap-up podcast series hosted by Jalen Rose and David Jacoby. Every week, the guys are joined by director Jason Hare to tell stories and take listeners behind the scenes of this great documentary. The podcast is presented by State Farm and AT&T. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA. Joining us from Boston, Massachusetts is Tim Bontemps. Hi, Tim. How are you? You wrote an interesting story this week that we're going to be talking about here in a minute. But first off, how are you?
Thank you, Brian. I'm good. And happy Mother's Day to everyone out there.
I will tell you that I'm wearing a mask that was made by Tim's fiance. She made masks. And I have a collection of masks that I use.
You're wearing hers, it now?
No, not now. But hers is the best of that collection. And joining us from Los Angeles is Kevin Arnovitz. Kevin, how's it going?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Kevin has fish in the oven on the stove?
No. It's on the counter warming to room temperature so that I can then sear it and then broil it.
There you go. Kevin is our resident foodie. What is the dinner plan for tonight after this podcast is done?
We're doing miso black cod with some Russian kale with a syrup, like a sake mirin, ginger, garlic, little sesame oil, kind of Asian flavor profiles here. And we're going to do a starter salad of arugula, fresh strawberries, roasted walnuts, and some goat cheese and balsamic.
This is how you roll.
Through and through.
This is how I get through quarantine.
I made chicken tacos for dinner. Okay, so we talked about the NBA. So on Friday, Adam Silver held a teleconference with the players. He and Michelle Roberts, the head of the players' union. They pretty much knew that it was going to get public. It was well covered. Woj had a lot of the details. There was a lot of focus on the immediate aspect of it, which was him talking about the timeline being pushed out, him saying he was not going to force the players. He did not want to have any pressure on the players to go into the facilities if they were not comfortable doing that. The thing that he said that I felt was really interesting, that for good reason has not gotten a lot of attention. It's okay. Was Tim, he pretty much came out and said the the CBA that we have, guys, cannot handle this. And the reason he's got to stay really close to the players on this is that at some point here, there's going to have to be an adjustment to the NBA business model, whether it's a short-term adjustment for the next season or whether it's a long-term adjustment. Nobody, I think, knows yet. But the last thing the NBA needs is a labor problem on top of a virus problem. And Adam, I think, is trying to get out in front of it by saying it. And I think it's one of the most important things that I don't think got discussed a lot from that call.
Yeah, no question. I'm on the same wavelength, Brian. And to me, it was, let's get out ahead of the problem and address it now and make everybody aware of it now, right? Because, you know, for all, like we talked about this on the pod last week with Bobby, whenever the NBA starts next season, you know, part of this, we might have to push stuff back. We might have to go into next year. Every game that the NBA doesn't have fans at it, it's yet another chunk of money coming out of the till, right? And, you know, like you said, the line from Adam that our CBA wasn't built for this, like, the NBA puts this thing together with the players. They have all these, you know, it's a very complicated equation, right? And it counts on all these different revenue streams, whether it's TV money, gate revenue, you know, all this other stuff. If you start pulling stuff out of it, well, then you have a system that's built on the cap going in a certain direction. It turns around and goes in the opposite direction. Well, then you have, you know, chaos with the luxury tax. You have players not getting nearly as much money as they're supposed to out of their paychecks. It impacts everybody. So, you know, one of the many things the NBA has to figure out is how are they going to balance that out, both not only how they manage that going into next season with whatever result comes of the season, whether there's no more games played or there's playoffs or they finish the season or whatever, but they're also going to have to do stuff probably with the season beyond because next year's finances are also going to be a mess. And I thought that Adam getting out there and saying that to the players on this call was the beginning of the kind of public campaign to set the markers for how those negotiations are going to go.
Yeah, and Kevin, one thing I think it's important to point out, while they have a long-term contract, I believe they've got 6 years left on their deal with the players, 5 or 6 years. Once the NBA enforces the force majeure, which they would do if they canceled a game, which I'm sure they're going to have to do probably at some point, they can void the CBA. They can take the CBA and just say, hey, this none of this matters. We got to start over. And that's a even within the contract, it's sort of a passing reference sentence, but it's a daunting reality. And I know that it's hard to talk about labor issues and your split and everything like that right now. But, man, it's Adam bringing that out at this point in this call, I think, was a real wake up for it was for me when I heard about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I had a conversation way back in March, which was the idea that the CBA, a renegotiation of the CBA was sort of how you maneuver the force majeure issue, right? So, yeah, theoretically, you know, the owners can invoke force majeure. You can whittle player salaries down to nothing. But how are the players going to feel about that, right? So it's a question of, hey, we're practical people, and so we're certainly not going to cut pay down to zero. If revenue is down an inordinate amount, you know, we need to account for that with player salaries. But by not invoking force majeure to the full power or to the full capacity of its power, now that's a bargaining chip too. Okay, so we don't whittle your salaries down to a minuscule degree, even though revenue is depleted. Okay, let's renegotiate the CBA, and hey, what will you give us? And it becomes – but it's tricky because, as you said, you don't want to antagonize the players at a moment when the league desperately cannot afford – any sort of, you know, a labor dispute. Everybody needs to be on the same side. I mean, you cannot fight this battle. And there's mutual interest. We've talked about this a million times. Every dollar that's recouped is split. So this is one of those cases where if you set aside the CBA, everybody's on the same page. Everybody wants to recoup revenue. But how you recoup it is going to be – those are the items that are going to be – in the event a CBA is renegotiated – and you tear up and you say, we got to start over, the current structure doesn't support it, then, okay, what do you want from the players? And you do have some leverage as owners, on, you know, because you technically this force majeure does free you up, but you're certainly not going to invoke it because there will be – and they would be right to be upset.
So, well, and just one point of clarification too. The CBA both sides have the ability to opt out of the CBA in December of 2022. So it's only 2.5 years from now. So it's really not like it's not right coming up, but it's also not that far away where this stuff that's happening now is probably going to have at least some bearing on whatever happens with these negotiations, whether there is a force majeure situation now or, you know, the side, one or both sides opt out in a couple of years and they have to come up with a new deal.
All right. So before we get in the weeds on that, we acknowledge that. One other thing that I think that he said that was interesting and I think is important to point out for fans because it can get confusing. He talked on there about not wanting to force the NBA players to have to be locked into a hotel room for 2 months on end, but also talked about wanting to bring them to one or two sites. And this is something that I think there's a difference between a bubble, which is where you're basically quarantined inside the four walls or the 12 walls or however many walls you're going to have. And nobody leaves and nobody comes in. That concept is one thing. And then a single site object is another. And what he basically said was, look, we are not interested in locking you guys in isolation to play. But, you know, he brought up Vegas and Orlando as options and has vaguely referenced both with the players and with the media, other cities who are interested. But I think it's important to point out the difference, Tim. It sounds like if the NBA comes back for this season, he does want all the teams to be together. And one of the reasons that that is something to look at beyond protecting from the virus, and this is something that has really shown up this last 2 weeks as they've tried to get facilities open, is across this country, different cities and different states are coming up with completely different timelines for when they're allowing things. And it's just it's going to be too complicated with 28 cities. And so I think that's what is going to happen is they're all going to come together in one or two places, but it's not going to be like, you know, what they have proposed out in Vegas where everybody stays in the same casino.
Well, it's a couple things, right? One of them goes back to the story we wrote a couple weeks ago now, right? Where it's that if you bring everybody to one place and you centralize it, it's easier to manage your population, right? And figure out what you need to test and how you need to handle it and all that and work all that stuff out. And the other part of it is what you referenced with the change in the NBA stance on testing at these facilities, right? Where you have in some of these local municipalities where there is enough testing, they're going to allow teams to test asymptomatic players at their facility. And in ones where there's not, they're not going to, right? So if you go to, say, Orlando, just as an example, where Disney is, Orlando's one of the places where it sounds like they're going to be able to test everybody. Well, if that's a place where there's enough testing, then you're not sapping that away from the local economy and the local populace to have the players go there and, you know, use your test there and do stuff, right? So, you know, any kind of bubble or single site or any of these situations are going to require a lot of logistics and a lot of jumping through hoops to pull it off. But certainly going to a place where you can remove one of those issues and kind of take away that testing hurdle, it's just one less thing that the league is going to have to worry about in trying to pull this off.
By the way, Brian, not to complicate matters, but in the CBA negotiation, players and owners, given everything you said and how we have 28 markets that are going to behave differently, that are going to have to respond differently, you know, revenue sharing is going to be another question. I mean, does the league have to nationalize? Given how difficult this is, you know, how is that going to play out? I mean, there's so many moving parts. I mean, you guys have covered CBA negotiations before. They're insane to begin with, right? Like when the league is prospering, they're difficult. When the league is not prospering, but it's predictable, think it's difficult. When the league is in this suspended state where we don't even know the nature of the revenue streams, how much each one is going to be diminished, like the revenue sharing piece is going to be impossible. I mean, you have 30 owners fighting over scraps, breadcrumbs at this point. And that's going to be an enormous issue if indeed this needs to be ripped up and started over.
Yeah. Well, stay tuned for that. Okay, let's have some fun with something instead of going into all this. Tim, you had a story written with Kevin Pelton and Bobby Marks that came out this last week. It's on ESPN Insider. It's the top – was it the top 100 transactions?
It was the top 74 transactions since the decision. Since the 74th year of the NBA's existence.
I see. Very clever. All right, so basically the top deals – signings, trades, draft picks, etc., of the last 10 years, essentially.
Yeah,
we're almost at 10 years of the decision. Not quite 10 years. Is a whole nother theoretical draft cycle. Now, there is no way that I would, and I talked to you during this process a little bit. There's no way that I wanted to. I'm not gonna like say, oh, this is ridiculous. I will just say that. This is one of those things that almost every fan will read and have some level of anger over. before we break into the – I want to look at the top – some of the top five, and then Kevin and I will talk about maybe our favorite or least favorite things here. Overall, what did you learn from this project?
Well, for one thing, I learned that 10 years is a long time. In that going back through and looking, like I just went through the basketball, like when we started this, we all just kind of sat down and came up with our own list of stuff that stood out to us. And going back to 2010 and looking through the basketball reference transaction lists and just seeing stuff that I'd forgotten about pop up, like one thing after another, it's a long time and a lot of stuff has happened. Like Kawhi Leonard was drafted in this decade at the beginning of it, and he and Paul George were part of this crazy, day in July this past summer too, right? Like those both those things happened in the same 10-year period. So that was one thing that really stood out to me. And the other one is just that I think it's good that the three of us all did it because we all kind of had, I think, a little different spin on it in terms of how we rank stuff. And this was a average of our three lists. And for me, the way I rank this stuff, and it'll get to a question I think Kevin will ask me while we're talking about it, is I was basing these transaction rankings off of how did this impact a championship or championships? And my top five transactions were all transactions that directly led to teams winning titles. Because I think that's obviously the single most important thing you can do. But that's not exactly how Bobby did it. It's not exactly how Kevin did it. So I thought it was a fun list that, kind of went in a lot of different directions. And like you said, anybody who reads it can see it and have their own opinion on how it shook out and probably disagree with most of it.
Well, Kevin, I will tell you that two of the top six transactions in the last 10 years were Kawhi Leonard trades. The number two transaction was the draft night deal with the Spurs traded George Hill, the Pacers for Kawhi Leonard. And a couple other guys, which Davis Bertāns is one of them. And the number six transaction was the deal that the Raptors made to acquire him from the Spurs 2 years ago or a year ago, whatever. I wonder if this is done again in a year for the top 75 transactions, if the Clippers signing him and Paul George slips into the top five or six there. Kevin, when you looked at this, well, you know what? I'm going to go over the top.
Read them out for us.
I'm going to go over the top six. So I just said number six was the trade, which was Gerard DeRozan, Jakob Poeltl, and a first-round pick last year for Danny Green and Kawhi Leonard, which getting Danny Green was more than a throw-in. I don't even know who that pick ended up being. It was a 30th. It was a 28th or 30th pick, something like that. So that was worth it to them. That was number six. Number five, Milwaukee Bucks select Giannis Antetokounmpo at number 15 in the 2013 draft. Now, this would not have been on Tim's list because it hasn't led to a championship. It may lead to a championship, and
yeah,
in short
I had
order.
Those. I had it sixth.
Okay,
on my personal list.
Number four is the infamous Nets Celtics trade where Garnett and Paul Pierce and Jason Terry. I'll point that out. Came to Brooklyn. They got three firsts and two swaps.
They got two firsts and three firsts and one swap. The other swap was in the other swap the Nets had was in the Joe Johnson trade to Atlanta.
It's a pretty good swap, though.
Yes, got him Jason Tatum.
It swapped from number three. What was the swap?
3 to 20-ish.
I think no, they traded back to get Tatum.
All right, they got the number one pick. Right, that's right. They got the number one pick.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Number three, the Harden trade Oklahoma City trading Harden to Houston, which was who became Steven Adams, the draft pick that became Steven Adams. Good player. Max player. Kevin Martin. What else is
and Jeremy team? Lamb.
Jeremy Lamb. Harden has won the MVP and could have won another one. Number two, as I mentioned before, George Hill. That was George Hill for Kawhi Leonard, Davis Bertans, and the rights to Erazem Lorbeck, who I don't think I ever played in the NBA. Number one, Warriors signed Kevin Durant to a two-year, $54 million contract in 2016. And it wasn't just the act of signing him. It was all the machinations that they did to be able to have Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, and Andre Iguodala on the roster with enough space to sign to that contract. Directly led to two titles in my mind and could have led to more had other things not happened. Kevin, kind of hard to quibble with number one. Do you have a quibble?
I have no quibble with number one. I mean, just because it fits Tim's criterion, which is, does it affect a championship? It was culturally, like, ridiculously important. It was narratively important. It perpetuated this notion of player, sort of player empowerment, and it became the most, like, the finest touch point of that debate since the decision. Like, it was really, I won't say it was decision two because there's nothing like the decision, but no matter what criteria you work on for this list, it fits all of them.
I actually had it second.
What did you have first?
I had the Steph Curry extension first because
but they're kind of related.
They are related, but the entire Warriors run, they're right. The team of the decade, right? The entire Warriors run doesn't happen without that extension. It allowed them to trade for Andre Iguodala. It allowed them to be in position to sign Kevin Durant. Everything that they did was all built around that extension. So that was why, to me, that's why I had that as the top one, because that wound up being probably the best contract ever signed in the history of the league, right? When you just look at the amount of value they got out of it. He won back-to-back MVPs, getting the first ever unanimous MVP on it. Now, obviously, I had Durant second, so I'm not quibbling. I had, like, no issue with being first, but I just thought that Curry extension was the foundation of everything that went on in Golden State over the past 6 or 7 years. So that was why I had that first, but see, all Kevin's points are accurate. This goes back to, you can flip a lot of these things around in a lot of different orders, and there's not really a wrong answer.
Yeah,
I like your thinking on that, because you're right. Without that value contract, none of this happens.
Though it was a risk reward that ended up hitting a 777.
Sure. Yeah. I'm not saying that Golden State signed it and it was like they knew what was going to happen either.
Right.
Like, it certainly isn't the case, but you just look it out all. Everything that flowed out from it, I had that number one. But again, you can go either way. And I had the Nets trade seventh and the Harden trade eighth. Because I had LeBron back to Cleveland in the top five, and I had those other four championship deciding moves in the top five. Because I stuck to that as that was how I was going to rank it.
So, Kevin, before I tell you, I don't really have a serious quibble with those top ones. There's ones in there that obviously are fresh, and it's hard. Like, for example, the Paul George trade for Gilgeous Alexander, Gallinari, and all of those draft picks. That is a conjunction trade with the Kawhi trade. So it's kind of hard to judge that. Also, we don't know what happens with that. You know, what happens with the Anthony Davis trade either is going to be a bounty for the Lakers because it will have been a major piece of winning them a title or more. Whereas it could also be something that sets up the Pelicans to take off around Zion Williamson. So a lot of this stuff is you have to time and place it. But I really have no quibble with those top five. I will just say before I turn it over to you, one move that actually is ranked 10th, and I think fairly ranked, a pretty good ranking, but I just want to talk about it real quick, which is was my lobbying for this trade. Did this help its ranking, Tim, at all?
Oh no, I had it high.
Okay, I mean, amongst the group,
I don't think so. I mean, I think everybody was pretty much on board with it. I think I had it 9th, but you know, everybody had it in the same ballpark for sure.
Okay, so the trade that the Cavs made a couple of months after LeBron, I mean, really, to be honest with you, the trade the Cavs made the day after the decision, which was to put LeBron in a sign-and-trade, and they got 4 draft picks. Now, it's hard to rank that high because those draft picks were Heat picks that were in the high 20s. But the fact that they were able to get 4 picks for a guy who was walking away, it helped them. It helped them. They actually used one of those picks to trade for Kevin Love. But the trade they made a couple of months after LeBron left, which was to trade Mo Williams and Jamario Moon for Baron Davis and an unprotected Clippers draft pick in 2011. That draft pick turned into Kyrie Irving. And, you know, there are a lot of people who talk about how the Cavs had incredible lottery luck those years LeBron was gone. They won the lottery 3 out of 4 years. It was amazing. But it wasn't always their pick. They jumped up with the Clippers pick that they traded for. And basically they got that pick for taking on the freight of Baron Davis, who they amnestied. But that was a franchise-altering move, getting that pick unprotected. And I don't think people – maybe I perceive it incorrectly because I've covered the Cavs so much. I don't know if people compute that transaction. They just think, oh, the Cavs got lucky and won the lottery and got –
oh, yeah, people definitely don't remember it. I mean, again, it's 9 years ago. Like, that's the thing. Like, that kind of stuff – that was some of the stuff that was fun to go back and look through, right? Like, you forget about moves like that. And so, the craziest thing about that was Donald Sterling and Baron Davis had a falling out, and he was like, get him out the door. And if they just waited 2 months, they could have amnestied him. Like, that's the bet. Like, the Cavs had him on their team for 6 weeks, and then they got rid of him, and they got the number one pick in the draft out of
him. Yeah, I mean, the thing was, like, you know, Chris Grant, who, you know, he didn't make it back. He didn't hold the job long enough to see LeBron come back, and David Griffin did a great job in replacing him. But Chris Grant did the sign and trade to set up LeBron after LeBron – when LeBron left, which – now, I just want you – I want to time and place this. The decision happens at like 9 p.m. The letter, Dan Gilbert letter, remember that? Comes out at like 10 p.m., all right? The next morning, Chris Grant's got to talk Dan Gilbert into trading LeBron, which not only was helping LeBron get more money because it helped in the sign and trade aspect of it, but also helped the Heat build their team more because it it enabled them to have some flexibility because they were able to reduce how much they were giving LeBron to free up money, blah, blah, blah. He talked him into it, you know, 12 hours after the letter. So he makes that deal. And then he makes this deal later on where he basically gets Baron Davis, who they amnesty. He's not even on their cap. I mean, they have to pay him the money. And then picks up Kyrie Irving. And then in the same draft, drafts Tristan Thompson. So within 1 year of LeBron leaving, they had drafted 2 of the 5 guys who are their starters on their championship team, and they have assets that end up helping them get Kevin Love. So anyway, all right, Kevin, the floor is yours.
No, your number 10 is one of my favorite kind of transactions, which are the butterfly effect transactions, right? They're the deals that precipitate the thing that's actually interesting. Right. So, you know, nobody cares about Jamario Moon and Mo Williams. It was about, and you could argue, I mean, does LeBron, and you kind of address this, like, does LeBron go back if Kyrie isn't as talented as he is, if they don't have
him? Well, LeBron would say he goes back no matter what, but that he went back at that moment, didn't give that Heat, give the Heat another year, was impacted by the fact that Kyrie was, had just won the All-Star MVP, as an example. So let me ask you about this one, Tim. You've got among these things that I found interesting.
Yeah.
First off, I forgot the deal for Rudy Gobert. I forgot that Rudy Gobert.
the Jazz got both of their franchise pillars in draft day trades.
Not just draft day trades. Draft day trades with Denver.
That's right, with Denver in the division.
Yes. Now Gobert was like the
27th pick.
27. And Donovan Mitchell was 12 13. Or 13.
They traded 24 and Trey Lyles to move up to 13 to draft Mitchell.
And let me just say something, and this, because this always happens with people talk about the George Hill Kawhi Leonard trade. Kawhi Leonard was the number 15 pick in the draft. Raptors, by the way, first team to have no lottery picks, I think, to win a championship. No, I think.
Correct.
Is that accurate?
Yep. Yep.
People always assume that, oh man, the Pacers could have had Kawhi Leonard. I mean, that, we don't know whether the Pacers would have taken Kawhi Leonard with those picks. When those picks are made, the trade is already done. They're drafting for the other team. Now, if it's the number one pick, like for example, you know, like when the Celtics moved back, they were moving back, you know, they were passing on Markel Fultz. That, in that scenario, you could have actually said, well, they passed on Markel Fultz. But in both of them, you cannot assume that if Denver had held on to those picks, that they would have drafted Mitchell and Gobert. But I forgot, and that's ranked 14th. I don't know if I said that. Number 14th on the list. That was a good one. But however, ranked 12th on the list, while we're jabbing the Nuggets, Nikola Jokic drafted 41. So pretty
and
good.
And also on the list is trading for Will Barton and Malik Beasley, giving up Aaron Aflalo for a future first, which turned into Malik Beasley, and got them Will Barton in that trade. And also on the list somewhere, I'm pretty sure, is the draft night trade they made with Chicago to get to move back a few spots, get Jusuf Nurkić and Gary Harris in the same trade, and give up Doug McDermott. So, you know, it's not like, you know, you can go across the league. Just about every team at some point or the other has made a pretty good move over the past 10 years, even if they have some, you know, marks on the other side of the resume too.
That's true. So one has on here that I didn't quite understand. So at number 39, Tobias Harris trade to Philadelphia. By the way, there's several Tobias Harris trades on here. Tobias Harris trades have made this, are on the list twice. Why is that? I mean, who's that a good trade for?
Well, I don't remember exactly where I had that trade. I think I might not have had it on the list at all, but I think, no, I had it in like the 40s or 50s. I mean, that's a significant trade in part because it set up both the Kawhi move and the Paul George move, right? Like, some of this, too, goes back to impact of the move, right? Like, Philadelphia trading for Tobias Harris, when Philadelphia trades for him, they basically commit to signing Tobias in the summer, right? In turn, that helps grease the skids for Jimmy Butler to leave because they didn't end up wanting to pay Jimmy Butler a max contract and Tobias Harris a max contract, right? So they then turn Jimmy Butler into Josh Richardson. Meanwhile, part of the assets that the Clippers got back in that trade for Tobias Harris, they turned around and traded for Paul George to bring Kawhi Leonard there, right? So I would have had it lower, but I think that's why it makes the list, because that move set up a whole bunch of other moves down the road that really shifted the balance of you know, what several teams are trying to do.
What you say is interesting, because I remember Kevin Pelton, who flies on the wings of doves, his trade report cards are the most, they're the most definitive. He gets them out like in 20 minutes. They're lucid. Like, he's a machine. He's like the greatest resource. But it was funny. A GM called almost like, again, 30 minutes after it published. I think he got a C-, and was just sort of yelling basically at Kevin to me, and just said, here's what you guys never understand. He's like, there's no such thing as a trade in a vacuum. You cannot evaluate. It's not just that you can't evaluate it today because you don't know what's going to happen. He's like, I get that. I mean, I understand that we're not going to see the results of this trade, and you guys have to do that. What bothers me is, and he pointed to sort of the fact that it was a product of the acquisition and what they're going to do. Like, it's a chain reaction within a team's front office. And the idea that you would ever evaluate one transaction without its larger context, without not having evaluated the trade that's coming next, which this is going to open up, which you can't possibly see because we – and that was sort of the thing. What's so interesting about this list is just how interconnected transactions are. It is really tough to evaluate trades, or if that meant any transaction, any signing, in a vacuum.
So a couple of interesting other points. Number one, there's two cap clearing trades on here that involved opening space to sign LeBron. The deal that the Lakers made with the Cavs actually on trade deadline day, where they cleared off Larry Nance and Jordan Clarkson to open up the cap space to sign LeBron. Although they could have done the deal with somebody else later on, but that's on the list, as is the deal that the Cavs made with the Celtics, which involved Jarrett Jack and some other pieces to sign LeBron in 2014. So two cap clearing crates to sign LeBron are on here. Also, I want to bring up the interesting role on this list of Isaiah Thomas. So you've got Isaiah Thomas being drafted with the last pick of the draft by the Kings in number 60 overall. You've got that as the 56th best move. Not on this list is Isaiah Thomas being traded from the Suns to the Celtics in a – they got like a future first or was protected or it was a really good trade.
It was a first-round pick. It ended up being a pick in the 20s somewhere.
Okay. I thought that was a great trade. And then you have the Kyrie Irving trade where Isaiah went to Cleveland. You have the Kyrie Irving trade all the way down at 70. This trade is very interesting. If we had done this list 2 years ago or even before last season, where does it rank? And the fact that it barely made—I mean, this was a humongous trade.
I'm not sure. For me, it would have ranked a lot higher for kind of the same reason. Like the year before, Kyrie didn't play in the playoffs, right? And he wasn't like guaranteed to be there long term. And we didn't really know what the situation was. And like for me, that was a big trade from like a structure of the league standpoint, right? Like, big name player gets traded. Obviously, the Cavs got worse because of it, but the Cavs got back to the finals that year, and then they were going to be underdogs anyway. Then they lost. The Celtics didn't really like. They kind of treaded water with Kyrie.
But at the time, it was like, oh,
no,
this
I understand
is, you
at
know.
The time, but I'm just saying, like looking back at it now, like it was a big trade because a big name player got traded. But in terms of the impact of the move, there wasn't a whole lot of impact really. Like, the Celtics got him for a couple of years. They didn't really go anywhere. And the Cavs still got back to the finals. And then when LeBron left, they were going to fall off anyway. So, I mean, that's one where, like, the stature of the player traded is, like, has a bigger impact on things than the actual move itself, at least for me.
Falls below a Joe Harris signing, a two-year, $2.5 million signing by the Nets. Just say Joe Harris,
yeah.
68th or 69th, Kyrie Irving, 70th. I mean, I'm not quibbling.
No, it's true. It's what makes the list interesting, right? Because it goes back to what you're looking at. Like Joe Harris going to Brooklyn, like them developing Joe Harris into a really good player, right? Was at least said to be one of the reasons why Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving went there, right? Not Joe Harris specifically, but like the culture that they built and the player development stuff that they did and the improvement that Nets team made over the past couple of years, like helped draw free agents there, ironically, including the guy next on the list.
So Kevin, two trades are on this list, and I think I'm really glad they're on this list because they began the path to a championship. Well, maybe not began, but changed everything. Two trades that basically changed everything. Number 58, Andrew Bogut and Steven Jackson for Monte Ellis, Kwame Brown, and Epe Udo. But basically, the trade that got Bogut and cleared out the spot for Steph Curry to flourish because right. Monte Ellis was moved. They get their defensive center, and they open up the – that was a – for which Joe Lacob was booed, but ended up being a franchise-altering moment.
Right, because people forget that – hey, is Ellis or Curry the guy whose hand you want the ball in was actually a discussion at some point.
Oh, yeah. I mean
that's what people forget.
Yes.
Like, there was a debate going on about which guard would be a better shepherd to the future than the other.
Yep. And I had that trade 29th, to be clear. Like, I thought that was a – for all the reasons you said, like, and again, going back to how I evaluated things, like, it ended up at 58th. I had it way higher for just that reason. I thought it was just a massively important move.
A friend of mine who covers the Browns says that, you know, Browns fans are addicted to 5-11. You know, they fight and, you know, get upset about players, stuff like that. And, you know, all they've ever known is 5-11. All those Warriors fans who were in love with Monte Ellis. Now, granted, he did have that one glorious moment, or he had a couple glorious moments, but they were addicted to 36 and 46.
Well, the Warriors were the Browns. And that's the thing people forget now. I mean, for 25 years, they basically didn't make the playoffs.
Right. All right. So here's the other one. This was a big one. And so, Kevin, I want you to talk about this one. But, Tim, this being on the list, tip of the cap for you guys having this on the list.
Can I make a guess?
Go ahead. Well, I kind of set it up.
Oh, I number 67.
Well, 67 is very good, but 68 is what I'm talking about.
Ah.
Oh, no, that isn't it at all, actually, what I was going to guess. No, go
this
ahead.
This trade changed everything. Rudy Gay to Sacramento for Patrick Patterson, Chuck Hayes, Grievous Vasquez, and John Salmons. That was the trade, the first significant trade that Masai Ujiri made as GM of the Raptors. It was supposed to be the beginning of a teardown. He was going to trade Rudy Gay, and then he was going to trade Kyle Lowry and begin a teardown. And then the team started playing so well after that trade. And Lowry started playing so well, they ended up keeping Lowry. And the circumstances of events from that ended up leading. Granted, none of those guys were still on the team when they won the championship, but Kyle Lowry was, and they were going to trade him to New York. And
James Dolan saved him from that one.
Yeah, but I think the Rudy Gay trade, I mean, if you talk to those guys, like that changed everything.
No question. And remember, another move on the list, Grievous Vasquez eventually was traded for a second round pick and a future first round pick, and one of the more inexplicable moves in recent memory. Grievous Vasquez played 22 games for the Bucks before he hurt his ankle and his career ended, and the Raptors got Norman Powell and OG Anunoby out of that transaction, which, you know, just again, like, the butterfly effect of this stuff is very
also
interesting to go back and look at.
And also, because what you were just referencing, Kevin, we all credit the Heat organization for trading for LeBron, the decision, which started this whole list. But the Heat's have two signings on this list after the decision that both made the top on this list. Number 67, which you just referenced, signing Shane Battier, 3 years, $9 million. And then the next year signing Ray Allen, 2 years, $6 million. Those two signings were major factors. Two relatively minor $3 million a year signs. Cause that's all they had. It wasn't like they were hard negotiators. That's all they had. But executing those two signings, Kevin, helped the Heat win the two titles.
Yeah, and Battier was one of those because, to me, I'm always interested less in sort of the specific transaction and what does it mean. And there was this notion of and our friend Tom Haberstroh has written about it a fair amount, and you've written about it, but just the idea of sort of the come to Jesus the Heat had to arrive at to play the way they could play to win a championship. And it was, hey, we kind of need that kind of player. We've sort of been all-starring it. And remember, the Heat lived in a world where, oh, we're going to get Eric Dampier. You know, we need four centers on the damn roster, Joel Anthony.
Jamal McGlure.
Right. And it was kind of the moment, the Battier thing was actually, you know, this isn't brain surgery here. It's a different kind of player, a guy who can just space for these dudes and can play you a little defense so that, you know, LeBron doesn't have to take that assignment. And that's kind of the thing with Battier. It's not so much that, Battier all of a sudden immediately became the fourth or third best player on that team. It was just sort of the moment of recognition is, wait, you mean for $9.4 million, we can solve a schematic problem we've had for a year and a half after we assembled the greatest team ever. Like, that's kind of what I love about that acquisition. Again, it's not a big money. It's not a cap thing, but it's just symbolically really important.
All right, we could go on and on with this list for hours. I mean, there's four moves that Danny Ferry made to build the 60-win Hawks on here.
I was happy about that, especially the Kyle Korver for the change in his cup holder was particularly good.
Yeah. Paul Millsap, 2 years, $19 million, as an example. All right, but if you – like, I'm going to tell you, like, every single one of these – if you're an NBA fan, even if you just look for your teams, because I think just about every team's represented. A lot of teams represented a number of times. And it's just interesting, as Kevin said, to follow the butterfly effect here. But it's a really good piece. It's on ESPN. I think it's under the ESPN Plus designation. So you're going to have to fork out a little bit for it. But by the way, the Isaiah Thomas trade is on here. That I didn't quite see it, but the Isaiah Thomas trade from I was wrong. The Isaiah Thomas trade to Phoenix is on here. There's three Isaiah Thomas transactions on here, and I argue there should be a fourth.
There's three. The trade from
Sacramento to
him
Phoenix.
Being drafted, his contract and the sign and trade, the contract which made him a super viable player, ended up getting flipped to Boston and then getting flipped to Cleveland. Right. I mean, pretty crazy 8-year run.
Wow. Amazing. All right. You should check all that out. I'm still learning things as I look at this list. Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. We will talk to you later in the week. Thank you for listening.